Before we begin, I just want to show you some slides which relate to the experiences I shared earlier on. It'll be a very quick slideshow. That's the pair of lotus feet where all of us find our comfort. You can move on to the other folders. This is the interaction Swami had with us. The top one is after Dasera. He's sprinkling the sacred water after the yagna on the girls and walking amongst us. You can keep going faster. And that's all the students giving him letters. As soon as he would come, everybody would rise with candy to bless for birthday or letters to give. And that's how close we saw him to take that picture. We didn't have fancy zoom lenses. He was right there in our faces. And that's Swami's birthday, I think 55th or so, in the darshan line. Again, his 55th birthday when I was a student at that time. And that's the Prashanti Nilayam we grew up in. Before the Saikulwant Hall came, all the trees were there and we sat on the sand. That's a group of girls waiting for convocation to get their degrees in the Purnachandra Auditorium. That's again Swami talking to us in darshan. Somebody from the fourth line obviously took this picture. That sari distribution, you can see the teachers, including Salokya Madam's sister, I think, is the person standing behind holding saris, Purna Madam. And that's again one of our warden, Jemma Madam, holding, and Swami's throwing it in everybody's lap, one each. That's the end of the pictures that I... And I also, before I begin, I forgot to mention one small example Swami gave us in the interview when he spoke about your ability to write your own destiny. He said if you're going to plant, for instance, a seed of a lemon tree, the little tree that will come out of it and eventually grow to bear a fruit, you cannot expect it to bear a banana or a mango fruit. A lemon seed will bear a fruit of a lemon. A citrus fruit, high in vitamin C with a thick rind. So whatever thoughts you sow today are going to determine the fruits in the future. That is what I meant when I said that Swami told us that every moment with your motives, your intentions, your thoughts, your choices, your actions, hidden, subconscious or conscious, verbalized, articulated or not, each of us is writing the software of our futures. So welcome back. Once again, I offer my loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet and pray to him to guide this session and to speak through me. Sisters and brothers, Sai Ram to all of you. As I told you earlier, the 6 years that I spent in his proximity, Swami loaded with me with so many life lessons that even today, I'm still struggling to grapple with them and put them into practice. Just when the cup of my joy was overflowing, he threw me in a very different environment and he expected me to actually now practice them. And as I struggled to remember his message and apply it to my life in a very different situation, I realized that now he had finally actually enrolled me in the real school. Till now it was all one blissful experience being at his lotus feet. Bhagwan says that much is expected of those to whom much is given. As his students, each of us has received many gifts of his grace. But much as people resent all the privileges we enjoy as students, little did we know or do they know that once we leave the portals of his institution, we are also given a fair share of challenges and opportunities to see if we can practice what he has taught us. My circumstances have given me many, many such opportunities where I had to remember and go back and say, what did Swami say that might apply to my situation here? Actually, I graduated at the time of Swami's 60th birthday. You know, November 22nd is the convocation day at Prashanti Nilayam for all university students. They just had one convocation yesterday. My convocation was at the time of the 60th birthday. Today we are celebrating his 83rd birthday. And believe you me, every single moment I feel like his student. And I feel completely answerable to the chancellor of my university. And I feel he never stops testing me. Perhaps he thinks I'm not getting there, so keeps repeating a lot of lessons. And I'm always enrolled in this program called Life 101. Don't seem to make much headway sometimes. At times I feel Swami is really putting me through some high-speed karmic workout. And bam, 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 he's throwing so many challenges at me. But I also know that as long as I hold on to that pair of lotus feet there, nothing can ever go wrong. As long as my radar is always pointed in the direction of those lotus feet, and as long as I chant the most powerful name, the name that is more powerful than any nuclear weapon, Sai Ram, I will always have him to guide me and navigate me through every difficulty in my life. Within months of returning from Swami's college, after my master's degree and so on, I got married. And I was extremely naive at that time because I grew up in a very sheltered home, and then I went to such a sheltered university that my parents looked so illiberal living in Anantapur. And I had been subconsciously programmed to view the world through the Sai lens. So I thought if I saw everything through the prism of Swami's teachings and I lived my life through the prism of, you know, truth and peace and right conduct, everything would be fine. Little did I know that I would be thrown in situations where I would be faced with a lot of conflicting values and I wouldn't know my place in the world, and too many other pressures would cloud my judgment. At the time of my wedding, my parents gave me a beautiful picture of Swami, autographed by him for me, which he did it for a friend at Anantapur who gave it to him just before my wedding and mailed it to me. And this picture of Swami with his signature on it, which said, "Love, Baba," was the most important part of my trousseau that my parents ever gave me. Because when I got married, I pasted this picture inside the back wall of a steel cupboard I had in the balcony of the flat in which I lived in Delhi. And every now and then, when I used to feel confused or worried, I would just go to this balcony, open my cupboard, pretending to, you know, be looking for some clothes, part all the saris on the hanger, and then see Swami's picture right there. And in that quiet moment, I had my private conversation with him, and it was like, you know, when your computer is going haywire, you press the Alt-Control-Delete, and you reboot. That's what I did in that corner, standing with Swami. At that time, there were no other images of Swami in my house. There was no mention of him in my family. Actually, you know, as they say, everything happens at a perfect moment. And in my case, that perfect moment continued to elude me. And I continued to have this secret umbilical cord of that connected me to Bhagwan, and it was always in my prayer, silent prayers, and in my dreams and visions. Even before I could celebrate my first wedding anniversary, on the 1st of January in 1988, I woke up absolutely ecstatic, and I woke my husband up and I said, "You know, this is our first New Year together and it's going to be a wonderful year for us." And he said, "Well, how do you know?" And I said, "Because I dreamt of Swami." And I had this clear and vivid dream in which Swami came. He didn't speak to me, he just gave me this beautiful Pad Namaskar. I could feel the satisfaction you have when you kiss those beautiful divine lotus feet, the joy, that surge of comfort and happiness. And he placed his hand on my head. And I said, "Nothing can go wrong. This is going to be the best year ever." And he was very happy for me. He said, "Sure, great, sounds like a plan." And he had to leave immediately because he had a business trip to go to, and then he was leaving out of town. So he left like even before breakfast, and then I got ready. Surprisingly, it wasn't a holiday, January 1st. And I went, I was riding a scooter with a family member, a two-wheeler, to go to work. He said he would give me a ride. And I remember, all I remember of that morning was, I'm on the scooter, and because I always pray while traveling or driving, I was chanting the Mahamrityunjayai mantra. I was chanting Om Trayambakam, and I sensed some fear and everything went blank. I have no recollection of that moment. Later I found out we had met with a severe road accident where I was somersaulted off of the back of a scooter across a very busy road on one of the busiest traffic major intersections in Delhi at rush hour traffic. I was not wearing a helmet. I went somersaulted across like three lanes of traffic and hit my head on the curbside. After some time, I have no recollection of this. And all I recall is I was crying in acute pain, and a very kind family came with a van and a pillow and lifted me and took me in this van back to my flat because the accident happened very close to my house. Because my dad was visiting me at my home, and from there my dad joined us and we went to the emergency ward of a hospital in Delhi. There I was diagnosed with several broken bones, cracked ribs. I was bleeding profusely all over. I had many gashes and cuts and a severe head concussion. And then the doctors just abandoned me in one room saying that somebody would come to stitch this deep gash in my knee. Even my bone was exposed, and they told me to wait there next to another patient. Now this other patient was a burn victim, and her condition was so terrible. She had been burned by her husband and her in-laws for some dowry death dispute, and this poor lady was dying, and there was this callous, heartless, horrible police officer sitting there and recording her statement like a matter-of-fact manner. So here I'm dying and I'm ready to get up and punch this policeman because I'm so mad at him for being so heartless. So my dad realized, you know, this is not a good situation to have somebody with so many broken bones there. And my dad tried to reason with the police officer and, you know, say, get her some help and do something. Nobody was interested in that. Nobody was going to attend to me. There was a lady dying next to me. Nobody wanted to attend to her either. So in the process, my dad and I realized we were making no headway. So my dad got up and cleaned all my wounds and all the blood everywhere. And we sat in that room, and my dad and I prayed as hard as we could to Swami, and my dad pulled out this vibhuti packet from his wallet, and we filled all the gashes with vibhuti. We collected all our x-rays and we fled from that hospital. We thought that was the safest, sanest thing to do under the circumstances. And then I went for treatment elsewhere. And very soon I began to recover, and you know, the dislocated shoulder was on the mend, and you can't do much with your broken ribs, and wherever I had wounds, they started to heal. But I was haunted by these horrible headaches, and they were so massive, and my doctor told me that I needed to see a neurologist and get a CAT scan and stuff like that. I was very new in that city. And we were just a young couple. We hadn't been even married a year and didn't know our way around that much. So as usual, I prayed to Swami, and the first clear thought that came to my mind was of Dr. A.N. Safaya. Dr. Safaya at that time was the director of a very prestigious medical facility in Delhi called the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. And as some of you may know, he currently is the director of the Sri Sathya Sai Super Speciality Hospital in Prashanti Gram. I had met him with my parents many years ago as a student in Puttaparthi, and he's a Sai devotee. So I suggested to my husband, why don't we go and seek his help with regards to my CAT scan and all the other medical attention I needed. And when I went there, I was waiting outside his office. I got very anxious and nervous, and I thought I was being so selfish. I hadn't kept in touch with him, and he may not even know me. And what if he doesn't recognize me? And I'll make cut such a sorry figure after telling my husband, you know, because, you know, we are all one family. Everybody in the Sai family is one, and it doesn't matter. I can go and approach Dr. Safaya. So I sat there, and my password to all cosmic systems is Swami's name. So I pulled out my visiting card, and I wrote Om Sai Ram on it. And I told his assistant, can you just deliver this for me? And the moment Dr. Safaya got my visiting card, he came, he called us in, and he was profusively helpful and very welcoming. And I was thinking, you know, I'm seeing him after so many years, and he's met me so briefly a long time ago, maybe he won't even remember me. And you know what was the first thing he said to me? He said, last night, His wife and him were just talking about me. I said, really, how come? He said, we were watching Swami's 60th birthday video and we saw you receiving your degree from Swami's hand and we were wondering whatever became of you and where you had disappeared. And here I was with my, in tow with my husband and my father-in-law in his office. And of course, after that, he took care and helped me greatly to get all my CAT scans and all my treatment done, and I was fit as a fiddle and all fine. And just as I thought things were really getting better, Swami was always had something in store for me the very next moment. But throughout this period, when there was no physical presence of Swami in my life, he came in my dreams very often and blessed me. And my dreams were very private, and they were all mine. But I missed him terribly, and I pined for him, especially on festival days. My perfect fantasy of a Diwali or a Dasera was very different from the situation that Swami had left me in. And I used to seize every opportunity, every chance I could possibly get to visit. If I was driving by a church, I'd tell my husband, let's go in and get some blessings. If we were driving by a gurdwara, a mosque, a temple, anywhere, we went everywhere and anywhere, because every time I stepped into any place of worship, all I could experience was Swami's presence. In Durga's face, I saw his compassionate eyes. In Krishna's mischievous smile, I saw him taunting at my misery and my separation anxiety. When I went into a mosque and I heard the azan, I could hear was the vibration of the suprabhatan in Prashanti Nilayam. And very often when he came in my dream and blessed me, I'd get up very excitedly and I'd tell my husband that, you know, today Swami came and gave me namaskar, today Swami came and gave me vibhuti, and he was very happy for me at all times. But it was not realistic of me to expect him to understand to what extent Swami was involved in my day-to-day, moment-to-moment thought processes, my work at home, my work in the office. For me, Swami was this omnipresent presence within me. And that realization, I think, each of us is destined to grow into in our own time, according to our spiritual destiny. 20 years into my marriage, today my husband and I are singing to the same symphony. We are on the same sheet of music, playing our notes in the same key. But to get to this point has been a very difficult journey. And many times through this journey, I resented it and I was so mad at Swami for putting me through it, and I blamed him. And when I look back, all I can say is I should only be grateful, because each of those disappointments was full of lessons for me. And the lessons he taught me are what is a resonance of what Swami told us in the interview, that character building is a lifelong vocation. The greatest lessons that Bhagwan has given me are acceptance, humility, patience, understanding, and knowing, most importantly, that he is the one behind the many that we come into conflict with all the time in our lives. And that every disappointment that I faced and any discouragement that came my way at that time was not a retribution from God, was his way of teaching me what I had heard from him in theory in those interviews, but had failed to practice till then. And I was telling the Sai youth yesterday, it was his way of teaching me to peel the mask, to see him behind every difficult face in my life, everybody who jeered and laughed at my faith in Swami at that time, that even behind that mask of sarcasm was Swami and none else. Within a year of my marriage, and by the time I had this accident, I was already working in a publishing company in an editorial position. And I was trying to pursue and advance my career, and I applied for a job as a television journalist. When I applied for this position, thousands of people applied, and there was a written exam without any preparation. I just, as usual, chanted Swami's name, and I wrote the exam, and I passed it. And amongst only a handful of people from several thousand people were invited for an interview. Now, when I got my interview call letter, I was very happy, and I wanted to prepare for this position. And mind you, I was newly married. I just started like running a home, and I had a lot of guests in my house, and I had a full-time job, which was deadline-bound. So I found myself unable to prepare for this interview. All I wanted to do was go to a library and read up some newspapers and get a hang of what exactly was going on in the world, because as a journalist, you're expected to know basic current affairs. And I worked for a feature magazine, so I wasn't on top of things. No matter how hard I tried each day, I'll schedule time to study, something would come and disrupt my schedule, and I was not able to do anything, and I was getting very frantic and nervous. Honestly, I did not even pray to Swami for help, but on his own he came in my dream when I was very desperate. Clear vision, like a movie. And in the dream I dashed and I said, Swami, I have an interview and I have no preparation, I don't know what to do. And I'm like venting and hyperventilating, and in his calm voice he said, don't worry, you study about Punjab. And he blessed me and gave me a namaskar. That was it. But when I woke up, I felt very calm and confident because Swami said, don't worry. His words, every syllable there is the Vedas, is the Rudram. So if Bhagwan said, don't worry, I wasn't going to worry. So now my quest was just find enough time. This was before the day of internet. I could have Googled Punjab and, you know, gone back 200 years in history in 5 seconds, but that wasn't so. So I thought I'll go to a library and read up just on the situation in Punjab. At that time, Punjab, a state in North India, was a very troubled territory. There was a separatist movement there led by Sikh militants, and they wanted to carve out a separate country, much like Quebec in Canada, for instance, or the IRA in Ireland. And it was a very volatile situation, and it was headline news. So I thought, okay, that makes sense. Now, the harder I tried to read on Punjab, the harder I found the time. Next day, I go to my work, and as soon as I reach my table and so many people are talking to me, I notice my desk is really tidy. But smack in the middle of my desk is a brand new copy of a news magazine called the Frontline Magazine. It's a feature magazine on politics published by the Hindu group of newspapers. And guess what? It has a cover story on Punjab. But because I was so preoccupied, I really didn't register it entirely, but I thought, okay, here's a good resource. I rolled it up and I stuck it in my handbag and I shoved my handbag in my drawer and I went about my work for the rest of the day. By the time I went home, I just had one Sunday left. I read this Frontline magazine like there was no tomorrow. I read the whole story on Punjab, every single word, and on the cover page it had little inset boxes of all the key players involved in the political drama going on in Punjab. I read up about each of them. It was the first time I was learning about the detailed analysis of the situation. So I was very thorough with the information and I went for my job interview. Now on the morning of my job interview, again Bhagwan came in my dream. In the prayer hall, the priest who used to perform arati when I was a student was performing arati in my dream, and I just had his darshan. So I woke up feeling so blissful, I could practically smell the camphor in the prayer hall and that vibration, and I was very confident everything would go great with me. But you know, I wanted to seal my fate really well, so I chose to wear the beautiful sari Bhagwan had given me for my convocation. I thought, now this is, in this sari I've got a namaskar, so you know, I'm even protected further. I wore that sari, I went for my job interview, and I was sitting in this very swanky, beautiful air-conditioned building where they seated all of us before we got called. And the people who went in for the interview before me were very senior journalists whose names I had read in newspapers. I was just a starter. I was a nobody at that time in that business. And I saw each of them stumble out of that boardroom looking extremely nervous and all flustered. I said, what happened? They said, oh, those guys are brutal. I said, guys? They said, yeah, there's a panel. There's a panel of three people and a camera in front of you, and they pose such tough questions. So whoever came out, I was like, tell me, what did they ask you about? So everybody said, oh, they asked us about the budget. They asked us about India's refusal to sign the non-proliferation treaty. I'm like, that's a big word I know nothing about. And they talked about improving the railway, the defense, Indo-Pakistan relations. I kept asking everybody, did they ask you anything about Punjab? No, nothing about Punjab. I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? And I got all nervous. So I remember I went to the bathroom and I'm praying to Swami, what should I do? And I saw myself in the mirror. I looked awful in that air-conditioned building out of fear. I was perspiring and my cotton sari looked like a rag. And I got such a sorry figure. I said, if they look at me, they're going to be, oh, she's not suitable. And then I thought, let me just run away because I know nothing that these people are talking about. But I remembered, I made a big boo-boo. I had given them my resume, and on the resume, I'd written my qualifications. And everyone else said that they have your resume and your file in front of them, each of them. So I recall that Swami's name is on that resume. It says Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning. And then I also remembered I wrote this in a moment of foolishness. I wrote, I'm a gold medalist. And what a sorry figure will I cut, because when they will realize I know nothing, they will say they give gold medals to fools like her in that university. This university must have a very poor standard. But then, should I run away or not? I said, no, let me do the right thing. Let me just face the music. I sat there chanting the Gayatri, and I psyched myself into believing that when I go inside, all three of them are Swami. I am Swami. The air I'm breathing is Swami. Swami will do everything. It'll be all good. So when I went in, I was quite calm. And actually, they were very pleasant. I was like, what is everybody talking about? They said, oh, please, you know, they were, what do you do? And they talked to me about my current position, which I was very happy to talk about, because it was not about India's a refusal to sign the non-proliferation treaty. And after we finished all the pleasantries, they said, and I felt very comfortable and at ease, one of the older gentlemen said, you know, if you're hired for this position and you're asked to do a story on any important topic, let's say, for instance, if we assign you to do a coverage on the situation that is currently prevailing in Punjab, how would you handle it? And I was grinning. I was like, yes, thank you, Swami, this is it. And I must have come across as such a happy candidate, because that was my topic. Remember, I had read all 24 pages on that Frontline magazine end to end several times over. So I started rattling off everything I could talk of, all plagiarized and borrowed from the Frontline magazine, my analysis. And they were nodding and very impressed. And then the other person said, so if you go on this hunt to, you know, do the story, if you have to interview some key players, who would be your choice? Now, remember, there was an inset box with all those tiny faces of people who were the key players. I rattled off names like this. And little did I realize in my enthusiasm that I also named the major militant, the leader of the separatist movement, a person named Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale, the biggest Khalistani. And I, so, you know, he was one of the key players on that inset box. You know, I had just sucked in all, inhaled all that information. They said, that sounds very interesting. But if you're doing this story and you start to interview the Khalistani leader, and you air his views on national television, a billion people are going to watch him. And don't you think you're going to glorify a man who wants to break away? He will come across as a hero, a martyr. He's a rebel who can publicize his cause using the powerful medium of television. What do you think about it? And that part, the Frontline magazine did not discuss. So I was completely foxed, and I said, yeah, in my heart I'm saying, that's so true. How come I never thought of it? That was such a foolish suggestion on my part to say that, you know, I would interview this guy. And I was so frantic, I was frozen. And I said, Swami, you have to help me. I have no idea what to say. And the three of them are looking at me. And I just said, Swami, speak. And I found myself speaking so eloquently, so logically, so forcefully. The first word that came out of my mouth as I watched myself, I observed myself, say, momentarily, yes, I think it will possibly has the potential to sway either ways, but everything depends on your interviewing technique. An interviewer can make or break the interviewee. Depending on how I handle this interview, I can make Bhindranwale sound like a patriot, are like a terrorist. And the three of them are nodding in agreement, and so am I, because I loved that performance. Whoever was speaking, it wasn't me. I had never thought through any of this. And then I went on to say things which I wasn't even aware of. I'm rattling this Russian jargon. I'm saying things like media has to practice this concept of perestroika, because only when there's a glasnost approach to communication will this medium build its own credibility. These, you have to keep in mind, I was 24 years old. I was a naive girl who came from an ashram life, and I did not know these clever things and clever words and clever perspectives and strategies. Never been to a journalism school or anything. And I'm making a whole lot of sense, and I'm just watching myself perform, and I'm in awe of this person who's speaking through me. Because he who is the voice of the Vedas became my voice. He thought through me, he spoke through me, he performed through me. And I'm finding these people nodding so well. And they seem to be like, we were like jiving like friends, and everybody else said, they're so brutal, this panel in there. And that wasn't my experience. Not to mention when the results came out, I got in and I was somewhere on the top, because God can never fail. When you surrender your ego, when we surrender everything we have and we give up and say, you take over, Swami, nothing can ever go wrong. It's only as long as we resist him, fight him, and try to do things our way, that's when we expect results a certain way. And I think the only reason, the fact that I completely surrendered in that moment of panic, like I never have surrendered, I had never surrendered so intensely till that moment, is why Swami really spoke through me so intelligently. My vocabulary changed, my delivery changed, and the effect of what I was saying on those people was just outstanding and amazing. I think that job was given to me by Swami because he wanted me to grow. Because, you know, I thought everything can be, you know, everybody should live a good life and be a good person and everything will be well with the world. And then he threw me in this situation where I was covering 1 minute, I would be sent to cover a bomb blast in Old Delhi. The next minute, I would be sent on coverage to the red light district of Old Delhi, where some very helpless and hapless women were pleading with the media to help them because none of their children could be admitted to the local municipality school because some bureaucrat deemed it necessary to have the name of the father on the birth certificate. So these people, their situation was so pathetic, and they were crying and saying, do something, tell someone, get your camera to shoot up light, tell the world, we don't know whose name to write there, and our kids are denied an education and forced into this trade because they're illiterate and they're desperate and they're poor. And next minute I would be covering maybe the Pakistani snipers pointing their guns at me on the line of actual control that divides India from Pakistan. Now this kind of exposure, it just completely shook me from, I had never been exposed to such brutality, such disparity, and it was so agonizing. It just tormented me because, you know, living in Parthi, Swami gives you food, free education, saris, clothes, happiness, mommy, papa, happy. I lived that perfect, sheltered, in the box life. And I agonized and I came home and I always wondered, life is not fair and there are so many horrible things happening out there in the world. I saw how political decisions were driven only by greed. Licenses were given for industry at the expense of huge environmental costs. And nobody seemed to care. I was meeting with policymakers and I realized everybody had a hidden agenda which was very individualistic. And nobody was thinking of the big picture of the welfare of the community or the society or the country. Everybody was thinking of their pocketbook. I met the richest of Indians who live like kings, and I met the poorest of Indians who did not have a piece of bread, a grain of rice to eat. And when I saw the disparities and the pathetic conditions, I kept going back to Swami and saying, who's supposed to solve this? How the government is doing nothing. The NGOs, they do their little bit, not big enough to resolve. I am a hapless single individual. I can't solve the world's problem. Swami, just pick up your magic wand and, you know, erase all this inequality in one go and make everything perfect. And then the answer I got was, if Swami really even did that, in a trice, we'd all be in a state of pristine equality. But it won't take us long to plunder ourselves, our neighbors, our planet, our resources, because everything we do it for greed, for selfishness. And the only way we can ever resolve any of this is by practicing selfless love. Only Swami can bring about that change, not by using his magic wand to wipe the slate clean, but by transforming each of us, but one single human heart at a time. And that is what he has been doing since he declared his mission at the age of 14. His only expectation of us is that each of us open our hearts enough to embrace his teachings unconditionally and wholeheartedly. And in doing so, we first have to accept ourselves for who we are and accept everyone else for who they are. Because in the end, everybody is simply him. It's strange how devout we feel when we sit for darshan and when Swami goes at aarti time and you can smell the agarbatti and the bells ringing and, you know, it's evening time, you can hear the birds chirping, everybody's on such a spiritual high. And the moment we leave the Sai Kulwant Hall, searching for our chappals, tokens, going to canteen, meeting my friends, I have to be at this place, all that just evaporates. It just disappears. And when we are dealing with people after that, who seem to be not following rules, we are first quick to remark, quick to criticize. All that Swami wants is that at all times, we maintain that emotional and mental state of mind that we seem to possess when we are sitting in darshan, sitting in front of the altar, performing bhajans and pujas as we are today. And the need to do so is immediate. It is the immediate now, this very moment. Why, might you ask, is there such an urgency? Because the current moment in history is truly momentous. The collective human consciousness is undergoing a seismic shift. The divine power that is beyond birth and death, but has cloaked a human form, is at the last stages of his career as an avatar. Meanwhile, equally significant is the fact that the world's richest democracy historically and the greatest economic power is a key player in defining the parameters for the pursuit of happiness, material happiness. More important than that is the fact that Prashanti Nilayam, India, is emerging as the spiritual capital of the universe. And I say the universe, not just the world. And its resident, Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, is the greatest universal world teacher, divine teacher on the world stage at this moment. The city of Chicago in particular is the epicenter of a change that Americans have chosen to believe in. And the mood of hope that is sweeping your national psyche at this moment, and by extension, the rest of the world, is so because at the end of the day, all is one. As the great philosopher Mufasa said in Lion King, one of my favorite movies, in the great big circle of life, we are all connected in more ways than one. Many people think that the economic recession in the US will have a ripple effect, obviously, in the economies of Asia and of Asia, such as China and India, Latin America and Europe. All true, we're already seeing that. But the ripple effect is at all levels, emotional, physical, mental, spiritual, material, at all levels, absolutely. Yet despite the gloomy state of the economy and a gloomier forecast by the International Monetary Fund for the year 2009, there seems to be some hope and a whole lot of soul searching going on in boardrooms as well as trading floors. Perhaps because of the financial carnage that we have experienced and the recent collapse of capitalism, decision makers, policy pundits, economists, and life coaches are all reviewing and going back and raising some very interesting existentialistic questions. People are beginning to review the place of motives and intentions in all areas of life, including business and economics. Now, what exactly led to this meltdown, the subprime meltdown that has really shaken everybody's life in this part of the world? Who would ever have imagined the ripple effect it has borne? Lehman Brothers, AIG, would you have even dreamt of that? The very process of due diligence that was conveniently forsaken when approving loans to creditors who did not have a good credit history may sound like an oversimplification. But I dare ask you, where was the truth in that business practice? Where was the right conduct in that business practice? What was the motive? We all know that a number of executives along the food chain received massive bonuses and commissions for approving blindfoldedly as many home loans as possible, creating an artificial demand in the marketplace, creating a bubble that had to burst sooner or later. And even as we bemoan and question and point fingers to blame each other and find the cause of all this, that this recent financial debacle, pain, poverty, illiteracy, exploitation, hate, and environmental pollution remain humanity's greatest challenges. Challenges that can annihilate an entire generation. Driven by greed, somehow led by this engine of materialistic wealth, this great country, a great democracy for which I have a lot of respect, America, human society seems to measure all its success based on three parameters: expansion in market share, profits, and gross domestic production. However, corporate scandals, business malpractices, they're all raising questions about the need for using spirituality in the workplace and the place of values and ethics in a workplace. Even in politics and governance, Americans have clearly voted for a transparent, accountable, and ethically credible alternative. It appears as though the multi-trillion dollar package may not be able to even restore these self-inflicted wounds that humanity has carved on itself. Yet, what is the role of Sai devotees in all this? Where am I going with all this? Those of us who live in the awareness of Bhagwan's teachings have to realize that the answer to all our individual, collective, national, global problems is selfless love that Bhagwan personifies. Nothing else can bail us out of our current situation. And truly, love is Wall Street's true bailout package. And not only for Wall Street, for the White House, the Capitol Hill, or a sub-Saharan village affected by AIDS. We need to be kinder to ourselves, to our neighbors, to our friends, to our, more importantly, to those who we perceive as our enemies, whether as persons or as a nation. And we need to question our motives behind every choice we make. Is it based on truth? Is it based on right conduct? Because Swami's values are so commonsensical that for a stable political career, for a good professional life, for a good personal relationship, whether it's in a marriage or between a child and a mother, the same values are what help us succeed. The pursuit of happiness based on selfishness and greed and the desire for instant gratification has to be exchanged for a larger picture where everybody realizes that we are connected to everybody else. Market manipulations, quick profits, and ruthless environmental exploitation and waging of wars in the name of democracy or anti-terrorism are just a few loveless practices that will leave behind a trail of negative karma that nobody is immune to. And that is what leaders are now beginning to realize. You and I, as Sai devotees, have a huge role to play in ensuring that this seismic shift that is taking place goes in the right direction. We need to balance our priorities and revitalize ourselves spiritually. In this connection, I'd like to share with you one instance that Bhagwan gave us in an interview. One time, he told us about this country called Japan, and he said, you know, in Japan, they have high-rise buildings, they have such a high GDP, people have wealth, everything, there's so much of opulence, is highly advanced, there is no poverty, there's no lack of medical care. But do you also know something else about Japan? And we're like, wide mouth, what, Swami? He said, Japan has the highest suicide rate. He said, material wealth alone will not confer happiness. For a bird to fly and soar high and steady, the bird needs two wings. And both the wings have to flap in sync, and both the wings have to be strong. Similarly, for each of us to succeed in life, we need to balance our spiritual and material pursuits with care and not get obsessed with one. I was telling the Sai youth yesterday, I think that's what happened to all the traders on Wall Street. They watched the secret for attracting wealth and manifesting the wealth, attract the success you've always dreamt of. They watched that highest selling DVD video called The Secret, and they all obsessed themselves so much with wealth creation. And Swami says, for a car to drive successfully, all its four tires should be balanced and aligned and have equal air pressure. If you're going to keep putting air in one particular tire to the extent that it will burst, you will not have a mobile vehicle. And that is the balance and moderation that all of us need to practice in our lives. Just to give you a sample of the universal nature of Bhagwan's teachings and its appeal, I'd appeal to each of you to please read the November issue of the Heart to Heart magazine. How many of you are familiar with that magazine? Thank you. It is an e-journal that comes out of Prashanti Nilayam, and it can be found at the ashram's website, radiosai.org. And if you read the cover story, it profiles Swami's love as experienced, understood, and translated into real life by a wide segment of people coming from different backgrounds, different continents, different cultures, and different religions. And it's just mind-boggling. The Lord of Puttaparthi, who sits so quietly in his Yajur Mandir, is actually the force that is bringing about this huge spiritual revolution in the world. He who sits there quietly granting darshan twice a day is also the power that beats in your heart and mine. And he's the one who fills us with light and confidence to undertake at least something similar to what he has achieved in one lifetime. Swami says, we are also avatars. The only difference is we're not aware of our divinity, and he is. The moment we become conscious and self-aware of who we truly are, all our hang-ups, all our prejudices will fall by the wayside. And we will embrace everybody, including those who don't dress like us, act like us, behave like us, come from the same background as our own, because even in them, Swami resides. It's very hard to overcome your prejudices, and it's very hard to actually practice this sense of oneness with everybody. I had a very interesting episode where I realized that truly Swami is in everyone, and how easily we misjudge others just because of their appearance. A few years ago, we had an annual event at my workplace where I work, the Satya Sai School of Canada in Toronto. And this is a brushomania. It's an oral hygiene campaign we do every once a year. I'm sure schools in Chicago also do it. And a dentist and an oral hygienist come and talk to us about good stuff like plaque and flossing and the correct method of brushing our teeth. And that year, funny enough, there was a big RV, a mobile hospital from Colgate, a dental hospital, that came to our school as part of this experiential learning, and it actually came from Chicago, I remember very well. The Rotary Club had sponsored this, and when they came to our school, The hygienist took all the students in batches to see the little dental hospital, and then she spoke to them. And when she was done, it was my job to serve them tea. So I said, how many people on your team? And she said, oh, it's just me and the driver of the truck. He's in the parking lot in the truck. So I prepared some snacks and tea, and I took it down for them into the RV, mobile hospital. And when I was serving this tea, I said, where's the driver? She said, he's behind the curtain. So there was a little curtain, and I went knock, knock on the curtain, and the person who pulled it apart, he just filled my vision. He was this ginormous being, giant of a man, 6 feet and several inches tall, huge. He must have weighed 200 pounds. He was Caucasian. He had dirty blonde hair, Rastafarian braids everywhere. He had a bandana. He wore a leather vest. And he had humongous and scary tattoos all over his body. And he wore jeans. And when I saw him, I said, oh, hello. And, you know, I think I'm quite a people person. But for a second, I was taken aback. And then I greeted him and I said, can I interest you in some tea? And I found him extremely polite. When he spoke to me, he was very, very polite and pleasant. And he took my tea and he was done. He drew his curtain again. And the dental hygienist said, you know, I need to ask you something. I've been to hundreds of schools because I'm part of this Colgate school outreach project. I've never come across children like your children. What is it about these kids? I said, well, what did you find different about them? She said, they have excellent listening skills. Their sense of engagement was fantastic. And they were holding on to everything I said. And the questions they asked me were very intelligent. They're so bright-eyed. There's something special about them. So this was my opportunity, you know, to strike. I said, you know, we have a very special program in place. It's a character education program. It's called Satisai Education and Human Values. And she goes, oh, what is it all about? And before I could speak, the ginormous being behind the curtain, he parts the curtain. He says, what did you just say? I was taken aback. I said, no, I was just explaining to her why these children are so well-behaved and disciplined and very good listeners. He goes, yeah, tell me. I heard you say something. I said, it's because we have this program, and I tried to go slow. I thought, you know, he may not understand. I said, it's called the Satisai Education in Human Values. Before I could finish, he goes, Sai Baba, I know Sai Baba. I'm like, whoa, you know Sai Baba? Like, this is the last person I'd expect, a truck driver, you know, looking like one of those. We have this motorcycle gangs in Montreal called the Hell's Angels, and they drive these motorcycles with bikers gangs. He looked like the member of that gang, and he's like, I know Sai Baba, tell me more about it. Which one are you talking about? The bandana Sai Baba, the Afro Sai Baba? So we got talking, and we were like jibing and exchanging notes, like connecting like two soybeans in a pod. And the poor dental hygienist, she was just wondering what happened here, you know. She and I were having a conversation. Next minute, I and the driver are connecting like siblings from another life. So I said, why don't you come inside the school? He said, can I? I said, of course you can. So I took him into the school. And the moment he stood in front of Swami's picture, he started shivering. He said, I can't believe my destiny has brought me here. I feel my soul has been washed. And I said, what happened? He said, you know, I'm a member of a group near Gainesville, Florida. He mentioned a name like Church or Board of Sweden. I tried to Google it. I couldn't. I think I must have the name wrong. And he said, for all our sermons, I always get a quote from Baba. Because what he says is so fantastic, you can never go wrong with his advice. And I'm like, I'm with you, brother, absolutely. You can never go wrong with his advice. You stay there. And then I started to tell him, we were telling him about Swami, and he said, where can I get? He goes, I can't believe that it's my good fortune. I've been to so many schools. I've never even looked at the name of the school except to get to the door. And that I actually came to Sai Baba's school. I feel so blessed. Can you tell me where I can get more information on the internet? As I was telling you earlier yesterday, I'm very cautious about the internet websites that I recommend to people. So we were trying to caution him, and even before we could sort of say it in a nice way, he goes, oh, don't worry, I completely understand. Anytime an apostle of truth has come, somebody out there is going to have a huge problem. But you just give me your literature, I'll go to your school's website and check it out. And there, you know, who would have ever thought? I would never have dreamt that this person was such an intensely devoted to Swami person. So then he went about his way, and I went down to the RV to collect my dishes. and to take everything back. And just as I was doing that, straight out of a Hollywood film, he grabs this tray of dishes from my hand and he puts it to a side. He gives me the biggest ever hug in my life. And you know, you have to keep in mind, I was raised in an ashram. It's not every other day that I typically go about hugging people of the opposite gender. So I was so squirmy and uncomfortable. I'm standing there and I said, what happened to him? This man is sobbing on my shoulder, crying like a baby. So I tried to, you know, so huge, I tried to pat him and say, calm down, it's okay. Don't worry, everything will be okay. He said, I just can't contain myself. It's the joy that I stepped into that school and I saw his picture. And he said, I feel so blessed, I'm crying because I feel something within me has just awakened. And in that moment, the awkwardness of that moment just dissolved. He just felt like a fellow seeker, just another sibling. Of course, in this case, a sibling, a brother from another mother, but a very different looking mother, I would say. And I realized how easily I was given to misjudge him and avoid him because he looked so terrifying and different from me. And I had no business to do that. And in the course of my life after that, I realized Swami has made me interact with people who looked hostile or unfriendly. And at the end of the day, if you approach them with love and you share love with them, everybody responds positively. Because all our experiences in the end are the three R's: a reaction, reflection, and resound of our own thoughts, our own emotions, and our own feelings, and nothing else really. Brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, all I want to leave the parting thought is that the light of love and the source of this universe is walking amongst us as one of us. He breathes the same air that we breathe, and he has made this earth hallowed by his divine touch. Time is of essence. Time is running out, not for him, for you and I. We really need to take a moment to rededicate ourselves to his mission. To live in the awareness of his presence on earth is such a big blessing, but to be part of his mission is even a greater blessing. To be associated with an organization that bears his hallowed name is a fruit of good karma we must have done over millions of lifetimes. The moment to revitalize ourselves is now. I'm so grateful to Swami, my family and I, for all that he has done for us. And I know I can never do anything enough to repay my debt. But by just living in a state of gratitude and appreciation, I think, I hope I can win his heart. I hope I never, my prayer this, on this 83rd birthday that I want to place at his lotus feet is simply this: Swami, I hope I will never give you an opportunity to regret including me in your divine master plan. Thank you and Sai Ram. It's been such a pleasure to join you this afternoon.